Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call, a show created at KALW with the support of listeners like you. As you listen to the programming you value, give your support to KALW's September campaign. Join us for the first time or renew your membership at KALW.org. Thank you. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United States is often praised as an exceptional country, a classless society with endless opportunities, where everyone can succeed if they just work hard enough. In her new book, White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America, today's guest, Nancy Eisenberg, debunks that widely held popular myth. She writes, quote, "At all times, white trash reminds us one of the American nation's uncomfortable truths, the poor are always with us. A preoccupation with penalizing poor whites reveals an uneasy tension between what Americans are taught to think the country promises, the dream of upward mobility, and the less appealing truth that class barriers almost invariably make that dream unobtainable. Of course, the intersection of race and class remains an undeniable part of the overall story." She goes on to write, "Class separation is and always has been at the center of our political debates, despite every attempt to hide social reality with deceptive rhetoric." Nancy Eisenberg is the T. Harry Williams Professor of History at Louisiana State University. She's the author of a number of books. Her most recent is White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Hi, Nancy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Good. It's great to have you. Your book, I should say congratulations. It has been on bestseller lists here in the Bay Area and at the national level. It's a very timely book. I want to start off by talking about where we are in our present day. And I'd love to get your analysis of Donald Trump and a lot of his white supporters. He has been described for over a year now as a populist candidate. Even though he's part of the 1%, his tax plan is going to the top 1%. First off, what are your thoughts about the media calling Donald Trump a populist?
Yeah, it's funny. I was just asked to participate in a survey that also described Trump as a populist. And I kept thinking that just doesn't seem the right word. Part of the problem is the legacy, the history of that word, because if you actually go back to the populist movement, which started in the late 19th century, it was nothing like Donald Trump, because the populist movement, the forefront of their enemy was corporate power. The kind of ruling elite that had acquired great wealth and privilege from the federal government, such as the railroads. The other thing is that the populist movement, at least for a period of time, attempted to bridge across the racial divide and recruit working class whites and working class blacks. So I think part of the problem is that when we use the word populist, it's sort of code word for going back to talking about, you know, poor whites. But the difficulty is that the populism that Trump represents doesn't have the political content of the earlier populist movement. Where Trump can be seen as a populist, and I've written about this, has to do with his self-presentation. I mean, his success is that he speaks in a raw, unscripted language. You know, he uses rudeness. He uses insults. He's not constrained by the well-measured idiom of the politician. And this is something, unfortunately, which is more about American democracy, particularly a southern version of American democracy, in which politicians have been required to entertain audiences. We think of this as something new. We think, oh, Donald Trump, reality TV star. But in fact, this has a much longer history, because an Australian observer described this phenomena back in 1949, and it's true today. He said, "Americans have a taste for a democracy of manners," he insisted, "which in fact was very different from real democracy. Voters accept huge disparities in wealth," he observed, "while expecting their leaders to cultivate the appearance of being no different from the rest of us." So Donald Trump has come down from his penthouse. He speaks supposedly in the voice of the common man. He, in a sense, makes threats that he wants to, you know, squash Michael Bloomberg or take a punch at a protester at one of his rallies. So that, in a sense, is where he's putting on the show, the sideshow, the con show, of pretending to be one of the people. But as you noted, his actual policies have nothing to do with populism whatsoever.
And what's so interesting is when we do hear Trump voters talk to the media, for example, the PBS NewsHour last week had a really good story about voters in Ohio, and they looked at voters in mostly Democratic counties. These are steel worker families who have voted Democrat, who have voted for Democrats their entire lives, and they're voting for Trump. What really kind of gets me is when these reporters interview these people, they get sound bites. And so we don't really know why they're voting for Trump, other than they're angry, obviously, because their jobs have left. Most of them have gone overseas. They're struggling to make ends meet. But the reporter usually doesn't say, well, Donald Trump's policies will mostly benefit the rich, so how is he going to benefit you? You know, we just get these sound bites. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean,
that is one thing. I noticed there was a journalist who actually went to these Trump rallies, and this was sort of early in the primary season, and he was kind of focusing on Trump's economic message. The one thing that is appealing to the steel worker is, you know, Trump selling himself as a headstrong businessman. He's going to create jobs. But the strange thing is, if we get back to his famous wall, part of what he's tapping into is the fear of labor competition from immigrants. And also, he's tapping in when he, you know, lashes out against companies leaving the United States and the global trade deals. He's really tapping into that anxiety of the erosion of unions and manufacturing jobs and the increase in low-paying service jobs that has. But this has been for a long time that we've had this decline in the, you know, the status and the job opportunities of people who were in industry. But, you know, this is in a sense what Trump is doing. His symbolic wall not only is about keeping immigrants out, but it's also for his followers who hate free trade globalism. It really means it's a kind of a symbol for keeping jobs in. Because the other thing that Trump taps into is this isolationism, that, you know, which is also symbolized by that wall, this idea, you know, the idea of putting America first, and that he quite clearly is making sure that, you know, when he talks about, you know, making America great again, even that slogan is about turning the clock back to the 50s and the 1960s when Americans' industrial workforce was healthy.
You could argue, and we've had many guests on our show talk about the fact that the Democratic Party overall, for the most part, has turned their backs on the working class. They've just obviously seen, you know, wages are flat. People are really struggling to get by. You have done extensive research in your book, White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. You looked at some of the founding fathers who believed poor people were subhuman and wanted to apply strategies used in agriculture and animal husbandry to improve the stock. What did you learn when you did your research? How is that helping you understand where we are today, especially when you look at, you know, Donald Trump being the Republican candidate for president?
Yeah, the critique that I have, there are a lot of people who've written about the Democratic Party, you know, the fact that they now kind of represent the professional managerial elite, and that their, you know, their interests, and this is, again, where, you know, people argue when it comes to Wall Street, there isn't that much separating the Democrats from the Republicans. But the problem, we have to be very cautious when we say the working class are all running away from the Democratic Party, because it's not true. People, working class people who are in unions tend to vote Democratic and are probably going to be voting for Hillary Clinton. And that's one of the other big problems, you know, when we look at Donald Trump. He's not supporting unions. And if you are in a union, you have clear advantages. You get higher wages, you get guaranteed benefits. the nature of unions have changed dramatically too. 40% of unions are women. We also have at least a third that are minorities. So it's not just the white working class male. And that's one of the critiques I have the media, is whenever they think about the working class, they think it's only white men, which is just wrong. It's just not true when we think about who represents working people. And they also tend to, and this is something even Bernie Sanders said, there's a problem where we completely ignore the poor. We completely ignore the fact that 40% of the population who live below the poverty line are white. And because you know, the politicians of both parties write them off because they assume they're not going to vote. So they don't, you know, appeal to them or necessarily address their issues. The other big problem is that I see with the Democrats, and this is what I've learned from my book, is this problem of Americans living this myth of the American dream. Which we tell ourselves over and over again as a kind of mantra, this idea that America broke free from the British class system in 1776, and what we promised from that day forward was that in America we wouldn't have a class system and that we alone were the country that did the most to promote social mobility. Now, the problem with that is it's not true, because if you go back to the founders themselves, and I write about Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, what they promised was not upward mobility on the social class ladder. They promised horizontal mobility. The metaphor of why America would be, you know, could promise opportunity was the vast continent. And that, in a sense, what they promised is that the poor could move west. But even that's not true. And Franklin sort of argued that this would create a happy mediocrity. We wouldn't have extremes of wealth on one end or extremes of poverty on the other end. It's almost like people would be spread out across the continent, so you wouldn't have an extremely hierarchical society. But they were wrong, because guess what? The class system moves west. And in the west, it was the powerful land speculators who were of the elite class who had access to buy the best land. They had the inside track with the land office officials. And in fact, many of the poor didn't even have the funds to buy the parcels of land that were initially sold by the federal government. And the Homestead Act, that's not passed until after the Civil War, because Southern politicians were strongly opposed to that. So this is one of the problems. And one of the things that's really scary is that even in 1990, the top 10% held equity in 90% of all the land in this country. So land ownership, I argue, has always been an important measure of class. Today, the symbol of the middle class is buying a home. But even the control of land, even the access to public lands, is another kind of vested privilege that the elite control. So we shouldn't be that surprised that a real estate man like Donald Trump is running for president.
Today we're speaking with Nancy Eisenberg about her new book, White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. And Nancy, what are your thoughts on how class is or is not covered in the media? The other day I found two articles that I think speak volumes about where we are right now. One in The Guardian, U.S. teens often forced to trade sex work for food. I mean, this is just horrific. This is a study by the Urban Institute. It described girls selling their bodies or sex for money as a strategy to make ends meet. Boys desperate for food were said to go to extremes such as shoplifting and selling drugs. This just came out recently. And then The Atlantic had a story about how even the AFL-CIO, when it looks at CEO pay, it doesn't tell the real story. And The Atlantic found that the average CEO who works for a Fortune 500 company is making about $19 million a year now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of, this is part of the problem. When we look at the persistence, you know, there are things we assume that have disappeared. You know, the sex trade, that, you know, in the early 19th century, where women were kidnapped and sold into sexual slavery. We still have sexual slavery today. And then, as you said, this idea that women still, you know, young girls have to sell their bodies. You know, this is an endemic problem. In the way in which women have always been identified with their sexuality. It's part of their cachet. Unfortunately, it's part of their social capital. And this is the other problem that we have. You know, we see these stories, But what I would like to see is for people to not just take isolated examples mm-hmm. of the way in which people are poor and suffering, and connect the two. the connection between when we do have these gross concentrations of wealth in the upper class, and that we have a shrinking middle class. And in fact, as I argue, the middle class was not stable in this country until after World War II, and it was because of the federal government. It was the federal government through the GI Bill, the federal government through insuring and backing mortgages for homes that created the middle class that we think, oh, this middle class has always been with us, but it hasn't. Hmm. Throughout the 19th century, there were numerous depressions, panics, people lost everything. I mean, even the fact that, you know, FDR guaranteed or insured the money that you had in the bank. These are privileges we take for granted today. But in fact, that's what makes it possible to have a middle class. You need the federal government to act as a broker, because the idea that the free market corrects itself is a lie. It corrects itself in the favor of the haves, not the have-nots.
So how do you deal with that at a time when there is such a push to get the public to hate government and expect nothing right. from government?
Right. I mean, that's the really disturbing thing. And this is something that Trump has taken advantage of, but it's been the litany of the Republican Party for a long time. It clearly is the message of the Tea Party. And it's sad, but it's really remarkable that we've gotten to this point, because, as I write, if you look at the Great Depression, this was an extreme, the first time that the federal government dramatically tried to improve the conditions of poor whites. And in the 1930s, 40% of the population were landless tenant farmers. Two-thirds were white, and they lived in the South. So one of the idea, and actually that's the same percentage, I argue, that existed at the time that Jefferson was writing the Declaration of Independence in Virginia. So one of the problems that I think that the ideology of the Republican Party has drummed into the heads of average Americans is to say the government doesn't help you, the government only helps certain people. This kind of reminds me of the old Jacksonian rhetoric when he went after the National Bank. And basically, you know, this there was a group of privileged people attached to the government who were the only ones benefiting. And therefore, everyone has to make their own banks. We'll have state banks. And then, of course, that really seriously hurt the economy. But this is part of the problem. We have a serious problem in this country where we are not only divided by class, but we're divided by region. Our old system, federal system, where we have supposedly a balance between state and the federal government, often works to the disadvantage of average Americans. I mean, if you live in a state like Louisiana, where I live, and you're poor, your standard of living is going to be much lower than if you are poor and you live in a state like Massachusetts. And this is one of the things that none of these people seem to realize. I mean, all the tax dollars that the government gets from northern states often is money that's then sent down to southern states. And we have very low state taxes. And again, people don't seem to realize that hurts people who are poor when you cut the tax base and when you rely on a regressive tax system and you tax cigarettes or you tax even food or prescription drugs in states like Louisiana. This all, in a sense, is part of an ideology. And there's a woman whose name escapes me right now, but she's a sociologist, been doing research of people of struggling white people and, you know, people who support the Republican Party in Louisiana. And one of the other problems that I think this appeal of hating government comes from is one that people assume, well, you know, life has always been bad, it's never going to get better. And then they're even stoic about this. They're willing to live in these heavily polluted areas because they think, well, that's the risk of capitalism, or that's the fate that's been dealt me. And I think that's the other thing we seem to forget. We seem to forget that there are groups of people who have felt ignored, have felt left out. And so the Tea Party anti-federal government rhetoric can be very appealing to them, even though, and this is the bigger problem, this is why Trump is so popular, is they're not thinking rationally. They're not actually looking at real policies. They're speaking from their own emotional point of view of how they define themselves and why they always feel as if they're forgotten. And scholars have also pointed out in the South, there's still the old Confederate ideology, the ideology that the government is really, you know, like meddling Northerners who are going to come in and tell us how to live our lives. And that still rings true in various parts of the South.
And then when you throw race into the mix, can you talk about what happens then? We, last week, were joined by Ian Haney Lopez, who is out with a book called Dog Whistle Politics. And it's about this sort of coded language that's really about race. And Republicans successfully get, for example, poor whites to vote for them, even though almost all of their policies are working for the 1%. And one of the lines in your book by Lyndon Johnson is very telling. Yeah. He says, if you can convince the lowest white man he is better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. He'll give somebody to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you.
Yeah, no, this is really a very sad and unfortunate persistent part of our American history. One of the things we have to realize is that from the very beginning, when this country was being founded, even in the colonial period, people were well aware that free labor and slave labor were in competition with each other. I write a lot about James Oglethorpe, who was one of the founders of the colony of Georgia. And he, at the early period of Georgia, kept slavery out of Georgia because he argued he was trying to create a colony for the poor, for debtors, like a reformed, charitable colony. And he said, if you allow slavery into the colony, you will disadvantage the free, you know, the poor, free white laborer. And this is one of the things that we forget, is that slavery created a very powerful landed elite. The power that slave owners had was not only the power to own slaves, and slaves, particularly as we move into the 19th century, were extremely expensive. And in fact, they shaped the entire economy of the South, because they were a form of equity in which slave owners could even get loans through slaves. And the other thing that's true is that slave owners, it was a very hierarchical system. So you find you have a powerful elite, a powerful family that is a large slave owner. They own most of the best land. They are controlling the government because they're the ones who get elected to office. And then it is their heirs, their children, who inherit those slaves. And we find that that power is transferred. And this is the important thing that I also say about class. Class is determined by passing wealth and privilege from parents to children. And it's still true today. This is what sociologists have found in 2015. The most important predictor of being successful in this country is the wealth and privilege that comes from parents to children. And this is something that even was noted in the important critique of slavery, of poverty in the 1960s, where the key author said that the real determinant, sadly enough, for who ended up being poor was connected to who your parents were. That being born to the wrong parents, it has so much impact in determining what you can do. We are marked by our class identity from the moment we are born. And this is something that Americans definitely ignore, definitely don't want to talk about. We'd rather say, oh, work hard and you can get ahead. Well, that's impossible because it's not a level playing field. And children today of the upper middle class have so many advantages. I mean, it's been shown that in our country, upper middle class people pass 50% of their wealth to their children. And that's not true in countries like Denmark and Sweden or even Japan, because they provide more social services. So we have replicated. We today, we tell ourselves, oh, we're the freest land, as if we're still back in 1776, when the facts prove otherwise. We are not. We do not have the most social mobility. There's more social mobility in Japan, in Germany, in Sweden, and Denmark than there is in this country.
Nancy Eisenberg is the T. Harry Williams Professor of History at Louisiana State University, and we're talking today about her best-selling book, White Trash, the 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions or comments do you have about class issues, how it's reported or not reported in the media? Nancy has done extensive research. It's such an interesting book about the history of class in this country. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. And Nancy, before the break, you were talking about wealth, and I'd never heard these statistics before. You write that Americans transfer wealth today in the fashion of those older societies, while modern European nations provide considerably more social services to their populations. So as you said, Americans pass on about 50% of their wealth to their kids, whereas parents in Denmark give 15% of their wealth to their kids. I mean, that's a huge difference, 50% to 15%.
Right, and that's one of the things I highlight throughout my book, is the importance. We have to realize the class is actually has been intimately tied to the identity of children, and that's something we tend to ignore. First of all, the way in which in the 19th century, white trash, the focus was on their diseased children. Their children were compared to albinos. They were seen as having yellowish skin because they're suffering from pellagra and hookworm. They're thin, they're emaciated. And children, in a sense, we forget how important they are in upholding the class system. The English idea of how class was sustained was passing property, you know, from property owners to their heirs. But in fact, if you're poor, you don't have heirs because you have nothing to pass on. And in the 19th century, one of the most disturbing things that we also tend to forget, we had child labor in this country up until 1919. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we forget is that poor children, and this is true of poor black children and poor white children, could be taken from their parents and basically turned into a coerced form of labor because they were then treated as apprentices. Their labor could be purchased by some, you know, wealthier person. That parents didn't even have the right to their own children, that they could be taken away from them. And this is one of the things that I highlight about Thomas Jefferson. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, at the same time, he made his very radical proposal to change, to at least provide some minimal kind of funding for education for the poor. And he basically argued that, you know, different communities, that, you know, the best and the brightest of the poor should be funded by the state. Now, he used a very derogatory term when he described how this system would work. He said they would be raking from the rubbish. but at least he was willing to support a few people who, in a sense, would be able to get an education and break out of, you know, the poverty trap. This bill was rejected by Virginians because they had no interest in supporting any of the poor, and in fact what they supported instead was this coercive form of apprenticeship where the beggars, children of beggars, would be taken from their parents and exploited. So that's one of the things we have to remember. We have to think of class not as something that's just determined by adult wealth or simply by the job you have. It's intimately connected to what you inherit. And this is why, I mean, Chris Rock has made a joke about how, yes, there are, you know, Hollywood stars who are black and extremely wealthy, but they don't have that lineage of old white wealth that goes back many generations. And this, we take this, we kind of ignore this all the time. I mean, Donald Trump, he's the child of wealth. And the nepotism that exists in Hollywood over and over again, when the children of actors are, you know, given jobs and they're not really very talented, we assume that this is, you know, this is kind of normal. We normalize this transfer of wealth from parent to child because we say, well, of course parents are going to support their children, and the state has no right to interfere with that. But in fact, if we don't look at that with a cold and analytical perspective, we're missing how our class system is sustained.
Nancy Eisenberg is author of White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. And Nancy, before we get to calls, can you tell us where the term white trash comes from?
Yeah, this is one of the most interesting things that I was able to unearth. Most people, scholars who'd written about white trash before my book, mainly start in the antebellum period in the antebellum South. And we know that the word white trash first seems to appear in newspapers in the, 1820s. But the problem with that is the concept is much older. And I take the concept all the way back to the early period for promoting British colonization in the New World. In fact, it was the biggest Elizabethan promoter, a man by the name of Richard Hakluyt, who argued that what the New World was for reducing the burden that the poor placed on England by dumping them into the New World. And in fact, the term that he used and his brother, who was also a promoter, used was to refer to these people as waste people. So the word that became associated with the poor was this idea of waste. That's why Jefferson and Abigail Adams referred to the poor as rubbish. So we have this consistent theme that white trash comes from people who, in a sense, cannot be incorporated into the economy, and the only solution is to dump them somewhere else. And then, of course, I could go and show you over and over again that when they meant waste, you can think of the worst illusion possible, and they meant that as well. The other origins, I mean, even the word rascal, believe it or not, which was used to describe the poor, comes from the word trash as well. So you have this emphasis on trash. You also have the language that associates the poor with the worthless land that they live on. And this is, my book focuses a lot on the rural poor because we were primarily an agrarian society. Most people lived in rural areas up until 1900. But the other association, the language that was used to describe the poor, such as pineys, sandhillers, hillbillies, even the word redneck, believe it or not, was associated with people who lived in swamps. So the other association was that these people were extrusions of the worthless land that they lived on. And then finally, the analogies that were very popular would be to compare them to inferior animals. They were called vermin. They were called curs, which is an inferior breed of dog. The word scallywag, which was used politically in the Reconstruction period to attack any poor white man, a Southerner, who supported the Republican Party. Scallywag is a word that comes from diseased cattle. And one of the words that I like the best is the word tacky. This is a word that refers to an inferior breed of horse found, of course, in the marshes of Carolina. So over and over again, every generation invented a new vocabulary, a new way to dismiss the poor, but we see consistent patterns. One is that they're worthless, they can't be assimilated. Two is that they're this emphasis I put on pedigree and breeding. They're an inferior breed of human, an inferior breed of white. And then also the idea that they are associated with landlessness. The other slurs that's usually associated with white trash was to compare them to vagrants, because the British hated vagrants, and this is the mobile poor. So this is the idea, the same way we have the homeless today, people who are seen as never having a stake in society. This idea that, and that gets associated with terms such as squatters and crackers, which is the way in which the poor who moved into the old Northwest or the Southern Backcountry after the American Revolution and into the 19th century, those were the two most popular derogatory terms to describe the landless poor.
And as you write in your book, the English wanted to get rid of these people and send them to the United States, which is what they did. You write, here was England's opportunity to thin out its prisons and siphon off thousands. Here was an outlet for the unwanted, a way to remove vagrants and beggars, to be rid of London's eyesore population. Those sent on the hazardous voyage to America who survived presented a simple purpose for imperial profiteers, to serve English interests and perish in the process.
Yeah, that's the thing that we tend to forget, this idea of that the solution to the poor was not to help them rise up in the society they're in, but is to push them somewhere else. And that same British imperial idea is the same idea that was used when the United States began to argue, as I said, with Franklin and Jefferson, that the poor could move west. That was another way to get rid of them. So we replicated that model. And the most disturbing theories that I highlight, and this is a theory that had both a racial component and a class component, really disturbing. This is in the antebellum period and the rise of manifest destiny. And manifest destiny was a vocabulary that was very much based on kind of a pre-Darwinist theory that inferior races were going to die out, which was used against native peoples, or that when we went to the Mexican-American War, we would win because we were fighting, quote, an imbecile race, a hybrid race of Mexicans. And then also the theory that became popular and was used to support the annexation of Texas was the idea that magically, because of racial environmental science, that inferior people would automatically migrate out of this country. They actually argued that free blacks, if we had Texas, would be drawn to Texas and they would keep moving and migrate out. And then the leading authority on the Southern class system, Daniel Hundley, used the exact same argument in 1860 to justify, what do we do with all the poor whites? He argued that, again, like nomads, they're going to magically migrate out of the country. Now, you know why people make this kind of theory. It means that you don't have to do anything. You don't have to provide any charity. You don't have to solve the economic problems. It is nature that alone will determine the fate of these people. But it's really disturbing, and it's an important part of our past that we have to embrace, that most Americans in the 19th century did not imagine that the poor were going to rise up. They didn't think it was even possible.
Today we're speaking with Nancy Eisenberg about her new book, White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a question that you may have already brushed on, which is, how can a candidate like Donald Trump, who's demonstrably very wealthy, represent himself as a populist and have people accept that he stands for the working people?
Well, we briefly touched on that earlier in the show. Nancy, what are your thoughts? How much of this has to do with all of the free media coverage that Donald Trump got last year?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, what I said earlier, I said that Trump's appeal is that it's the way he talks, the fact that he's raw and that he's insulting, and he sounds like a guy sitting next to you on a bar stool. I mean, people interviewed who supported him in the primary season said they liked his raw honesty. So his self-presentation in terms of the way he talks has been interpreted as somehow he can communicate with people despite the fact that he's, you know, stepped down from his penthouse and is seen as, you know, reaching out and talking to people whose life experiences are nothing like his. But, you know, I highlight this is what Americans like. Americans want our politicians to be performers. We accept wide disparities of wealth, but we want our politicians to pretend to act like us or to look like us. I mean, why do you think they have to go to Iowa and eat corn dogs and wear checker shirts? I mean, it's idiotic. But this is sort of a very old and long tradition that's part of our democratic heritage.
Thank you for calling in, Mark. Let's go next to Charles in Berkeley. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I very much appreciate the program and, Nancy, your comments, and most of which I agree with. But I have a couple of comments. First of all, I've lived in Japan about 20 years, and I'm married to a Dane and also lived in Denmark. And your points about social mobility in those two countries, I'm not sure that you may have statistics, but I'm not sure if they're correct. I may be bought into the American myth, but my sense is that there's still more opportunity for social mobility in this country. Japan has a very relatively large middle class, and any mobility that's occurred there has really only occurred since World War II. And Denmark, it's the social mobility there is largely due to the social welfare democracy that was instituted following, starting in the 30s, but really after World War II, and which is now in the 60s, and is now in abatement because of the more recent sort of Thatcherite programs that are being in place there. So those are two of my comments. Lastly, you just made a comment about why do people have to go to Kansas to eat corn dogs. And I think it is because the people really feel that they need to believe that the candidate has some knowledge of their situation. And if you don't go to Kansas and eat corn dogs, Kansans don't feel that Trump or whoever knows their situation. And also, they've had a chance to see that person in person rather than on TV. And that's true whether it's Kansas or Brooklyn or Berkeley. So those are my thoughts. Thank you so much for the program.
All right. Thank you, Charles.
Yeah, I could say, you know, with Denmark and Sweden, yeah, this is based on the studies of sociologists. And, you know, despite the, you know, their more conservative turn, they still, because they provide more social services, that means that real social mobility that can reach across the population is clearly more possible in Denmark and Sweden than it is in this country. As I said, the key to wealth transfer in this country is from parents to children. So if you're in the upper middle class, you can ensure the future of your children by that transfer of wealth. And I think that with Japan, it's more complicated. With Japan, this is, again, based on statistics of sociologists. But you're right. I mean, that they transformed their society in the post-world period. And that's part of what I'm saying. We, too, transformed our society. We had a more stable middle class because of World War II. But we have dramatically moved away from that, as we know, from the Reagan era, from the idea that, you know, that you can celebrate the, you know, calling the estate tax the death tax, where the estate tax is clearly an inheritance tax, which helps the super wealthy. This is part of the problem that we live in. We live that we have, our class structure has dramatically changed since World War II, and we refuse to admit that. And then on top, relay these myths that go all the way back to 1776, where we assume that we've always had more social mobility, which is not true in the past, in the 19th century or the late 18th century. But the last point, your idea that, yes, it's true that Americans want to believe that their candidates understand their situation. And this I could take all the way back to the Anti-Federalists and the way in which they... the idea of local knowledge, localism, as a way, because they were afraid, because of the revolution, they were afraid of a distant power, which is the same way the Tea Party looks at the federal government, that somehow they're so far removed, they don't understand the lives of the people who live in places like Iowa or Kansas. But the problem with all of that is it's become a game. And this game is really old. As I said, it goes back to the Australian Observer in 1949. It also goes back, I always like to tell the story of the Arkansas Traveler, and this is a story from the 1840s in which a wealthy politician goes out into the back country in Arkansas, and he sees a squatter, and he asks the squatter for a drink. Drink is a metaphor for a vote, and the squatter ignores him. So what does the wealthy politician have to do? He has to jump off his horse, grab the squatter's fiddle, and play his kind of music. And the problem with that is, yes, for the moment, the squatter feels as if the elite politician understands him. But as soon as that politician leaves and goes back to his wealthy mansion, nothing is done to improve the condition of the squatter, to improve the condition of his children. And that's the lie. That's the problem. Sound like you are an average person. Just because you have a style or a form of self-presentation or a performative, you know, image that makes you seem as if you're the common man doesn't mean that has anything to do with the policies that you back. And this is the really dangerous part of our system. We're so obsessed with the image. We're so obsessed with the particularly within television news. We're so obsessed with that that we never talk about the policies anymore. Mm. You know, it would be better if we never saw these candidates, if we only had to read exactly what policies they stood for. And then we'd have to make a more objective decision rather than deciding, oh, I like him because he looks like me, or he sounds like me, or he sounds like my uncle, or he's from my state, or all the things that have nothing to do with what they'll, the policies that they'll actually back.
Mm. Or listen to the radio to hear in-depth discussions about policies. That's the other solution there. And speaking of solutions, Greg, we don't have time to take your call, but Greg wanted to say, hardly anyone talks about the lower class or poverty. Bernie Sanders talked about poverty quite a bit, but he says even the Greens hardly talk about poverty. So what are your prescriptions for moving forward? I guess the thing that always gets me is we have solutions to so many of these issues, just lacking political will.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, even if you look at the issues that do get discussed, some of the most important issues get completely ignored. You know, I think that, you know, Bernie Sanders, I mean, he was actually being very honest when he said this. He's, you know, he was being critical of our political system. He was saying that the poor get ignored because politicians assume they're not going to vote anyway. And that's kind of, I think, this is another example of where are politicians only interested in the people who are going to vote for them? And we know that it's not the majority of people who end up voting in presidential elections. And I think that one of the things, and it's always very risky when politicians raise these issues. I mean, if Hillary Clinton, for example, came out with a program to address wide-scale poverty, I mean, if she tried to, you know, reinvent the Great Society by LBJ, what do you think would happen to her? How do you think the media would respond? How do you think the Republicans would respond? How do you think Trump would respond? I mean, this is kind of the problem we have with our political system, is that innovative policies usually are not the ones that politicians take because they're always seen as too risky. And then again, if they support a policy, this is why Hillary Clinton and most politicians always talk about the middle class, because we like the middle class, and we like to think everyone can be in the middle class. That's an upbeat storyline. Talking about poverty, again, then you would have people saying, oh, like in Fox News, she's fomenting class war. You know, even to mention class is attacked by saying you're fomenting class war. So this is the problem with our media-driven political landscape, that it's all about sound bites, it's all superficial, and it's all about image, and it's not about substance.
Nancy Eisenberg is professor of history at Louisiana State University and the author of a meticulously researched book. The notes are almost 100 pages. It's called White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Nancy, thank you so much for writing this book, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.